So I got my title from what Omar said a couple of days ago, that I work on the biggest accretion disks, but my actual title was this. So you can choose whichever title you want. I mean,
so
this is... Yeah. Right. So this is if you want to, you know, so that it's appropriate for the program. But I think actually, I think that galactic disks have a lot to tell us about accretion disks, and one reason is that they are spatially resolved, which I think you'll have a hard time finding other accretion disks that are so spatially resolved that we can actually see what's happening within them. Now, of course, there are a lot of other things going on in galactic disks as well, which makes it so you have to sort things out. So I'll be discussing work that I've done with my student Rob Piontek, and at Maryland, as in large part his thesis work. Although I'll be touching on a few other things that, based on work with various students and collaborators from the last several years. Okay, so here's what I'm planning to cover today, to the extent that I speak rather than us all discussing. First, I'll give some introduction on the interstellar medium for those of us who don't work on the interstellar medium, and then focus a bit on turbulence in the ISM, the causes, effects, and the outstanding issues associated with galactic turbulence. Then I'll get to the kind of the meat of the talk, which is the numerical models that we've been running to study the magnetorotational instability in the interstellar medium. Then I'll discuss some aspects of the interaction between turbulence and gravity, some of the things that we know and some of the things that we don't yet know and we'd like to know. And I'll finish up with a summary, and then we can discuss what we all would like to know. Okay, so some introduction first. Here's my favorite, actually, spiral galaxy seen in, actually, what can we do about the lights here? That one was a good switch. Yeah, that's a good switch. Good, nice. Okay, so now we can see my favorite galaxy. In both molecular gas in the CO molecule and in atomic gas in H1. Sorry, Stuart's name came out kind of too close in color to the background. So this is from the Bhima Song study of nearby galaxies, which is a large catalog of nearby galaxies seen in particularly molecular, but also in other wavelengths. So to characterize the interstellar medium on a global scale, the surface density, if you azimuthally average, the surface density runs from a few solar masses per square parsec up to a few hundred in the very central regions of galaxies. The profiles are not particularly regular, but they are sort of exponential, but they also are sort of flat in places. So there's no very well-defined law for the variation of surface density with radius in of the ISM. One thing you can say, though, is that in terms of how much they have of different components, in the atomic gas is less than about 10 solar masses per square parsec, because if you get above this, then it self-shields, and also the pressure is too high, and so it becomes molecular. So when you're up at 100 solar masses per square parsec, that's basically all in molecular gas. There are other components of the interstellar medium as well. There's warm ionized gas, and there's also hot gas, but those fractions of mass are quite small compared to the atomic and molecular gas. The volume fractions may be up to about 50%, but the mass fractions are small. The gas is distributed throughout the disk in a way such that the molecular component, as you see here, is preferentially in arms, and within arms, it's within gravitationally bound giant molecular clouds, whereas the H1 is diffuse. You can see here that the H1 is much more diffuse. And it's collected, the H1 gas is collected in non-self-gravitating clouds. In terms of the vertical distribution, at least for the Milky Way, The scale height is about a little bit more than 100 parsecs in the inner galaxy, and the disk flares as you get to the outer galaxy. The disk, basically because the vertical gravity of the disk drops as you run out of stars, and so the disk is flaring out to a scale height of about 500 parsecs in the outer part of our galaxy, and presumably in other galaxies as well. The midplane density, if you look in the inner part of the galaxy, is about 6/10 of particles per cubic centimeter. And this drops towards the outer part, both because you're running out of gas in terms of the total surface density, and also it's flaring, so it's more. Okay, so in terms of structure in the ISM, on large scales, as I mentioned, gas is concentrated into spiral arms. And this is just due to the fact that the gas, as it flows through the external potential, is flowing down the potential well, so it gathers in the minimum of the external potential, stellar potential. And also, self-gravity of the gas tends to make it collect linger longer in the minimum of the potential. So that's the larger scales. You see concentration in spiral arms. On intermediate scales, on medium scale, one thing that is new that's seen is what we call spurs, which trail from the arms into interarm regions. And I'll show you a picture of this in a few minutes. So these are separated by a few kiloparsecs, but they can trail over several kiloparsecs in the interarm regions. There's also, on medium scales, superclouds, which are composed of molecular and atomic gas and are fairly massive. And then in the hot gas, there are bubbles and chimneys, which are seen both in the Milky Way and chimneys, especially in external galaxies. On small scales, or small scales if you're talking about the whole scale of a galaxy, there are molecular clouds, these giant molecular clouds of masses of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 solar masses. And then similar to these, but somewhat smaller, are the dark clouds, which have masses of 10 to the 4 or so solar masses or less. These clouds are characterized by densities of about 100, so these are much denser than the diffuse ISM. The densities can get very high in clumps within these clouds and temperatures that are quite low. The cold atomic clouds, these are non-self-gravitating clouds, have densities typically of order 30 per cubic centimeter and temperatures on the order of 100 degrees and scales of up to about 10 parsecs. In between these clouds, so whatever of the ISM is not hot gas is basically diffuse warm gas at densities of a few tenths and temperatures of about 8,000 degrees, because that's what it wants. That's the temperature that's preferred by the cooling processes. But then there are also warm ionized and hot gas at higher temperatures. Okay, so there's turbulence in the interstellar medium. We see this turbulence. I'll concentrate on turbulence in the atomic gas because that's the diffuse gas. Molecular clouds, everyone, many people here have heard me talk about at other times the turbulence in molecular clouds. So the turbulence in the diffuse ISM, which is the accretion disk part of the ISM, turbulent velocities are measured by looking at clouds and seeing what their velocities are relative to the local standard of rest. So the turbulent velocity dispersion of cold clouds is about 7 kilometers a second, both for warm gas, that's down here, and for cold gas, based on emission and absorption measurements in 21 centimeter. For warm gas, this is not observed with such warm ionized gas. It's not observed with as good velocity resolution, but the velocity dispersion seems to be a bit larger. In external galaxies, it's not true that you can't, but it has not yet been possible to measure the true velocity dispersion directly, because they haven't been seen in absorption. So all you can measure is a total velocity dispersion. This is really turbulent, and this is a total velocity dispersion, which is between, say, 6 and 12 kilometers a second, if you look at a face-on galaxy and you're just measuring the total width of the H1 line. There is no secular trend in velocity dispersion with galactic radius, so even well beyond the optical disk. And it's also true that this total velocity dispersion is uncorrelated with spiral arm phase and with star formation. So let me show you that here. This shows NGC 1232 in a bad color. And here's the optical part of the galaxy. The H1 disk extends well beyond the optical galaxy, as do many H1 disks. And along splits in this galaxy, the velocity dispersion is measured, and there's no significant correlation with radius. This is increasing radius, and this is the measured velocity dispersion. Here, for NGC 1058, another Faison galaxy, at increasing, so this is increasing galactic radius, and this is azimuth. And this is the velocity dispersion as a function of azimuth at these various radii. So these dashed lines show where the spiral arms, at the peaks of the spiral arms. And you can see that there's really no correlation between the velocity dispersion and the peak of the spiral arms. Okay, so in addition to gas, of course, galaxy, the ISM is magnetized. Magnetic fields can be measured in various different ways in the various different components. In particular, in diffuse gas, the magnetic fields along the line of sight are measured with Faraday rotation, and also in the Milky Way and in external galaxies using synchrotron emission and polarized synchrotron as well. So in terms of the bottom line, the magnetic field on galactic scales is mainly toroidal, with comparable components of random field and ordered field. With a our galaxy, the local field strength is about 6 micrograss, and so in a range of spiral galaxies, the range of total field strengths is that range. Yeah. Well, we believe that to be the case. Yes. Both in our galaxy and external galaxies. There are reversals in the field direction, so it's mainly toroidal, but the toroidal direction reverses as you move to different radii in the galaxy. It's pretty large. It's several kiloparsecs, so that changes. So with these field strengths, the magnetic energy density is comparable to thermal, turbulent, and kinetic. Okay, so let me now outline a few issues related to turbulence. So I'll start with the astrophysics kind of questions. So kind of questions you might ask is, first of all, well, what generates these turbulent velocities, and also the turbulent and non-turbulent, for that matter, magnetic fields? Other questions you can ask is, what's the relationship between turbulence and physical structure? So how does turbulence affect the spectrum of masses of clouds that are observed? How does it affect the distribution of gas in the vertical gravitational potential? How does it affect the profiles of gas when you average, if you spatially average and you look at the profiles as you cut across, say, a spiral arm? And then you can ask from the other direction, how does the physical structure affect turbulence? So since we're talking about a medium that is not a single phase medium, but it's a cloudy medium or which has multi-phase structure, how does that affect turbulent driving and turbulent dissipation? A question of these kinds of issues, I think, that everyone has been talking about here for the last several months. Another question would be, say, how does the cloudy structure affect the turbulent power spectrum? And then one can also ask, well, how are turbulence and the thermal properties related in the interstellar medium? And in particular, is heating and cooling, you can heat from turbulence, but you can also cool because if you have local expansions, the rarefaction can provide cooling. So how important is turbulence in the net heating and cooling of the diffuse gas? So those are some astrophysics questions. Then some astronomy questions. I think the the big overall astronomy question is, how do turbulence and structure in the interstellar medium affect star formation? So here's my favorite galaxy again. Nice to have the light from the window right on the screen. That's excellent design. Okay, so you can see, in spite of that, you can see a lot of things in this image of M51. You can see very beautiful spiral structure. And then on top of the spiral structure, you can see these interarm spurs, so say originating here and sweeping back into the interarm region. And these kind of spurs are seen, so here it's seen in extinction from dust against the bright stellar background, but spurs are also seen in infrared emission, particularly they're very beautiful images from Spitzer, especially at 8 microns. You can see these trailing features originating in the arms and then trailing well into the interarm regions. So in addition to the structure in the gas, you can see star formation. So star formation is correlated with spiral arms, but it can extend into the interarm regions, and in particular it can be associated with these spur structures. So we to some extent we do understand aspects of how star formation is related to global aspects of star formation. So let me show you something that we've done very recently, looking at how these spur features are formed. This is a movie that's looping around, so you can see it over and over again. So this is a movie showing where we have an external spiral potential, and gas is orbiting in this external potential with self-gravity. And as you can see, it develops these interarm spurs. This is due to gravitational instabilities that originate in the arm. So we understand, or we're beginning to understand, some aspects of global star formation and how star formation is triggered. But there are a lot of things we still don't understand. In particular, the effects of turbulence on the star formation process. So massive GMCs are formed by gravitational instabilities of the kind that I just showed you. But how do the formation rates of GMCs depend on turbulence? How do the particular properties of clouds, their masses, their internal states depend on the turbulent properties of the diffuse medium from which they form, and other aspects of this problem? So this is, I think, an important motivation for studying the turbulence issues, even if you weren't interested in turbulence for its own sake. Okay, so where does the turbulence come from in the interstellar medium? Well, the traditional view is that turbulence is driven by supernovae. And you can look in Spitzer's book if the binding is still on it, or you can just work it out yourself. This is the traditional view. You put energy in from supernovae, and the energy is dissipated by cloud collisions. So put in the numbers. You can say, well, we form stars at some rate, which is the cloud formation rate. So this is energy in per unit mass per unit time. So per unit mass, in the diffuse ISM, it turns into a cloud in a cloud formation time scale. And then once it's in a cloud, there's some efficiency of star formation, what fraction of the mass ends up in stars. And then for the stars that are formed, what's the typical mass per supernovae? So that's a few hundred solar masses that are formed, turn into stars per supernova that blows up. Then there's some energy produced by each supernova, and that has some efficiency of transfer to the diffuse ISM. So this is turbulent inputs from supernovae. Then you can balance that against dissipation of turbulence. That is, you take the velocity dispersion and you divide by the characteristic collision time of clouds, which is typically about the velocity dispersion divided by the scale height. So putting in some numbers for each of these terms, one can work this through, putting in reasonable numbers, and you find velocity dispersion of about 6 kilometers a second. So you could say, oh, we're done, this explains everything, because it's consistent with observations. But I would say, be cautious, because a numerical coincidence doesn't mean that something is true. And in particular, there are problems with these scalings, which I won't go into in detail right now. So there are problems with, so just because it gives the right number doesn't mean that it's correct. And there are also problems empirically. That is, if you look at, well, star formation we know is intermittent. Stars go off not uniformly throughout the ISM, but they're correlated. This star formation is correlated with molecular clouds, and molecular clouds are not uniformly distributed. So star formation is very intermittent. And there's also no observed correlation of turbulence with star formation. As I showed, the turbulence is relatively, it varies, but not in a way that's correlated with star formation. And in addition, the outer disks lack star formation, but nevertheless, they appear to be turbulent. So although it's doubtless true that supernovae contribute to the turbulence in galactic disks, they are not necessarily the dominant source, and there may be other sources. And one of particular interest, that at least to this group, I think, is tapping galactic rotation via the magnetorotational instability. And as Selwood and Balbus pointed out, the parameters of galaxies are about right to think that the MRI may have significant amplitudes. So the principal difference in studying the MRI compared to what people have done in accretion disks is that the ISM gas is cloudy or multiphase. So our interest is to understand how this affects the development of the MRI. Why?
Because it's still subthermal field energy densities that are generated in the turbulence.
Well, I'll show you in a little bit that you actually can get significant magnetic fields.
And you can also get significant radial correlation in the cyclotron field as well.
Well, I think that's something that develops over rather long times that I don't think that we can say at this point. About the correlation scales. Okay, so just a little bit about what we did. So the models I'll show you were performed using time-dependent integration of the MHD variables with a version of Zeus. We implemented a simple atomic cooling and heating module, which is a fit to more complex cooling function of Wolfire et al., which accounts for many processes in heating and cooling in the atomic ISM. And our energy update is by an implicit solver because the cooling times can be very short compared to other dynamical times. In addition to cooling, we also implemented conduction. So why do you want to implement conduction? Why does it matter? Because with the kind of cooling function that we have, gas can be thermally unstable. And you want to make sure that you resolve interfaces between cold and warm gas and that you resolve thermally unstable wavelengths on the grid. Otherwise, you get unphysical growth at grid scales of condensations. We use a local Cartesian model with shearing periodic boundary conditions. And the models that I'll be showing you, we've done a variety of models. We've done poloidal plane models, that is XZ, or where X is a local radial coordinate, and so it's radial vertical over a box size that's sort of a cross-section through the galactic disk. We've also done 3D models in a paper that's now in press, and I'll give you a little bit on some stratified models that we're doing right now. And in terms of the initial conditions for these models, we initialize at a range of densities. We've also used varying magnetic field strengths, but I'll concentrate on showing you models where the initial value of beta is 100. And the initial pressure is characteristic of the diffuse atomic gas.
What's the rotation loop?
Sorry?
Is it Jupiter, or is it?
No, it's a solid body rotation. It's a constant. It's a constant rotation curve.
What's the Q gravity of your box? I know you don't have self gravity, but what's the primitive Q gravity?
It's not self gravitating, so. I mean, at these densities, it varies, right? So this varies from.
What's your initial?
I mean, I'm saying since we're varying the density by a large factor, the Tumori Q would vary from less than one to larger than one by this, so it's varying around one, because for n equals one, the Tumori Q is about 1.5 or so.
Even the case, this is just strictly no self gravity.
Yes, there's no self gravity. Yes, the surface density is varying because we're varying the total density and we're keeping our box size the same. So this is the initial density. It's uniform initial conditions. And I should say we have the field is it's a vertical initial weak vertical initial field. So what happens? Well, you start with uniform density, and if you start here at typical conditions, then that's thermally unstable. So if you put gas down here, what I've drawn here, this is in the density pressure plane. This here is the thermal equilibrium. Above this thermal equilibrium up here, there's net cooling. Down here, there's net heating. And these are isotherms that didn't come out very well. So at this density, it's thermally unstable. Anywhere on this part of the curve is thermally unstable. If you move a little bit in this direction, there's net cooling. That lowers the temperature, and it keeps going in this direction. And vice versa, on this side, if you move this way, it keeps heating up. So that's what you see happens. Some regions are slightly overdense, and they start to become more and more dense. They move this way, and they move over depth. They drop in temperature and they move to higher density and fill in on the cold phase over here.
I'm going to stop. I have a naive question. Maybe you said, and I missed it, but you have a thermal equilibrium. So the cooling you've discussed, what is the heating function here?
The heating function is constant heating.
Oh, you put that in?
Yes, it's constant diffuse heating. Okay. So it's modeling a combination of UV and cosmic rays. For heating neutral gas.
FGH.
Yes, that's right. It's Wolfire, actually. But it's essentially the same, except that there's FGH, we're assuming small grains, and the modern version of that is heating by a photoelectric effect on pause from UV. So the gas separates into cold, which is these bright spots, and warm, which is blue. So gas has moved over to the cold phase here and over to the warm phase over here. This is an unreadable roughly 20 million years. This is after about 500 million years. So remember, this is a 100 squared parsec box. So you get, at the end of the day, these cold clouds. Let me show a movie of this happening. Okay, so here's the cold clouds forming and moving around. The movie is looping around so you can see it happen again. So they just condense out of the cold medium, and then they have small random motions such that they will merge with each other. Okay. So if you do the same thing with magnetic fields, this is 2D. Again, this is the radial direction, this is the vertical direction. The gas separates into a cold and warm phase. It's very hard to see the magnetic fields, but they look like this. They thread through the clouds, and they have the magnetic fields bend basically where they're going through the dense clouds. In 2D, as with other 2D models, the channel flow will dominate at late stages. Okay, so let me move on at this point to 3D models. So this is, I'll show you a simulation from a 200 cubed parsec box. This is the radial, vertical, and azimuthal direction. So what happens first is that cold clouds condense out of the diffuse gas, and at this stage, at about this halfway through, you can see that MRI starts to kick in, and the gas becomes quite turbulent, but it still maintains its cloudy structure. This simulation runs for 9 orbits, or a few billion years.
And you're not capturing any of the heat by turbulent dissipation?
Well, we are capturing some of the heat. We're capturing the shock heating. Shocks are captured. We're not capturing the energy that's dissipated from the magnetic energy.
And there are shocks present in the simulation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's full of shocks.
And the simulation starts with a non-zero net flux?
Yes, that's right.
It's full of shocks because of the thermal stability.
Well, it's full of shocks because it's turbulent, and the motions are supersonic with respect to the cold gas. So the cold gas sound speed is about 1 kilometer a second. So you run these cold clouds into each other, and it's quite supersonic. Yeah, so it's quite supersonic for the cold gas.
What are the typical Mach numbers?
4. Because
16.
M is 4, M squared is 16.
That's much bigger than a standard MRI simulation.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because there's cooling. Okay. Shoot. Can't see a thing. This is the problem we're using. I wonder if we change this. Nope. All right, I'll just have to narrate this. Okay. This is the first time I've given this talk, so this is why there are certain PowerPointisms that may be not ideal. Okay, so if you look at what the velocity does, the velocity dispersion as a function of time, there's a low velocity dispersion initially. I'll just narrate it. I don't think I need the board. So the velocity dispersion does this. And it saturates at, you can just look at the numbers. It saturates at about 3 kilometers a second for the standard model of density of 1 per cubic centimeter. With larger velocities in the radial and azimuthal direction than in the vertical direction. The magnetic field strength that's here, can't you tell, again, increases and saturates at a value of between 2 and 3 micrograds. So for this, so that's a factor of 10 larger than the initial magnetic field strength. And the magnetic fields and the velocities are similar in all phases. So it's not like there's a big variation in either the field strength or the velocity dispersion. The cold medium is moving around just as fast as the warm medium.
So the, I don't know about the kind of pressure, an average pressure in this medium.
Well, there's still an average pressure because there's very close to pressure balance between, remember I showed you the, so there's close to pressure balance between the two components.
What kind of density contrast are we talking about?
100. Yep. So
how do you resolve that kind of an interface between the cloud and the intercloud medium? Is there really from grid to grid you could have a jump of a factor of 100 in the density?
Well, it's not from one zone to the next. That's why we include conduction. So their edges are a few zones. And they're resolved. We did resolution studies to make sure that we get the same results at different resolutions. We did a lot of resolution studies, and we did a lot of tests since we have very, we're working in a very new regime of very large density contrast. So if you look at the same thing for an all of the other parameters are the same, but for an isothermal model at the same initial magnetic field strength and density and the same pressure as the late stage pressure, the velocity dispersions are a bit larger and the magnetic field strengths are a bit larger. Okay, again, this is invisible. I can see it. This is a great way to give a talk. I can see it, you can't. So looking at how this is a log-log plot showing Maxwell stress, I think you can actually see these points very faintly. So this shows Maxwell stress as a function of the average density in the box. So we keep the average density the same, but what that means when it evolves is, sorry, we vary the average density, and that what, although the warm density and the cold density are the same no matter what. So lower average density means a smaller number of cold clouds. Higher average density means a larger number of cold clouds. So the Maxwell stress decreases as the average density increases, as does the Reynolds stress. And the scaling is such that the Maxwell stress varies as the mean density to the minus 4/10, and the Reynolds stress varies somewhat more steeply with density. This can be compared with results for kind of what you'd call single phase models, where from HGB, the stresses scale in this way. So if you just look at the scaling with density, this varies as density to the minus 1/2 power. And Sano et al.'s models suggested a dependence on the Alphane speed of varying as the 3/2 power of the Alphane speed. So that's a slightly steeper density dependence. So we're in the same range of, in terms of scaling with density for these stresses.
Is the streaky?
Well, you saw it. Do you want to call that streaky? I mean, it's filamentary, it's lumpy, it's filamentary.
It's streakier with time?
No. So the velocity dispersion is of significant interest here, since in part this is what we're trying to explain. The velocity dispersion scaling with density goes as a power about minus 8/10. And in fact, this agrees with what you would predict by balancing energy input with energy dissipation. So if you say you're putting in energy from the MRI at a rate that scales, well, a rate like this, which is just proportional to the stresses on the faces of the box because of the shearing boundary conditions, then putting in the scaling of the Maxwell stresses with density, the energy input rate scales as this power of density, and you can balance that input rate of energy with collisional dissipation of clouds, which scales with the mean density. So if you balance these, you get basically this scaling. So I think that can be understood. The velocity dispersion scaling can be understood on that basis. At low densities, too bad you can't see the numbers, but at low densities, the velocity dispersion can be quite large, so they're up to sonic with respect to the warm medium. And that means that the warm medium is reaching sonic velocities in terms of its turbulence. So these velocity dispersions are quite large, and in fact they are large enough to provide significant turbulence in the outer galaxy. Now remember, this is at low density. Where are there low densities? There's low density in the outer galaxy and also high above the galactic plane. Okay, so B squared, interestingly, yeah, you can see these little faint spots here. So this is the field strength is independent of density, which is unlike the single phase results, where the B squared is scaled the same way as the other stresses. So I think this is an interesting result. Why it is, I'm not sure. I certainly don't know, and I'm open to a suggestion of anyone who thinks he or she knows. Why? One remark is that in the saturated state, the value of beta is about 1. So this is both at high average density and low mean density that the magnetic field strength saturates at about such that beta is about unity. Yeah, isothermal. Right, I showed that comparison.
So
as opposed to... Well, but the accretion disk simulation, I mean, it's not, someone doesn't label it accretion disk, it's really just... Oh, but that it makes a very little difference whether it's Keplerian or... Yeah, we've looked at the difference between Keplerian and the constant rotation curve.
So you really attribute all these differences
to... Well, to the fact that it's a cloudy medium. To the fact that it's a cloudy medium.
So that makes the question, so if you said it's going to be very well,
mm-hmm.
so you've got one cloud overnight.
Well, it's not necessarily one cloud. It could be many small clouds. I mean, obviously, if you have... Continuously what? I mean, we could, but I'm not sure why we would do that. Why would we do that? I mean, we've done comparison models without cooling, as all the previous models have been without cooling. So there are many points of comparison.
The initial seeding of the clouds, that is, you put those in by hand or thermal instability made?
Oh, we've done it both ways. So we've done it both, thermal instability grows them and then they merge however they want to merge. And we've also done it by just putting in clouds by hand and we get the same results regardless. Okay. Yes?
Am I accretion disk minus accretion disk simulations
never
should
wait
a
second
to 1. No. Okay. I just want to neither. Yeah. So that is a difference between these simulations and the simulation.
Yeah, I mean it's close. They are close to. So beta is close to 1.
What is close to? I mean 0.9 or 0.6? It makes a difference by comparison. No,
well, it's larger than 1.
I'm thinking about
it. So, beta, the fields, the thermal divided by magnetic pressure.
Is it beta 2 or is it beta 1.1?
Oh, it's more like 2.
Okay. So that's not too crazy compared with the mean field.
Yeah, it's not. It's
alpha is not 0.6.
It's not that different. And the other thing is that. Oh, sure. I think the other thing is that these simulations are with a mean vertical magnetic field, which does always give you a larger saturation amplitude. I mean, you always get a larger saturation amplitude when there's a mean vertical field.
So you try simulations without a mean vertical field?
Yes. They give us lower amplitudes. But we like the high amplitudes. Okay, so in terms of the thermal structure, which is interesting for astronomers, because there's a fair amount of observational evidence on what the, or there is empirical evidence that that the gas in the ISM is not two well-defined phases, but there's a range of temperatures and densities. And we find that the pressure and temperature PDFs broaden with turbulence, but it does not produce a phase continuum, which some people have argued in favor of, but instead it produces just a broadened two-phase state. And the basic reason for this is that the cooling time is shorter than the time scale for turbulent energy inputs to occur. And that would be true even if we were fully capturing the energy. I can show you some numbers later if you like. So in terms of the total fraction of mass in the different components, the mass fraction in the cold component tends to increase with the mean density such that it's consistent with the static prediction at low densities. It exceeds the prediction. So if you have a static medium, then the fraction of warm gas should be just the warm density divided by the mean density. And then the balance is cold. At low mean densities, we don't go to a fully warm medium, basically because there's turbulent compressions producing cold gas. And once it drives it into the cold phase, it stays there. And the thermally unstable and the warm components have comparable proportion of the total, which is consistent with observations that suggest that there's a comparable amount of thermally unstable and warm gas. The cloud mass function here peaks at masses of about 100 solar masses. So that scale, the corresponding physical scale, is about 7 parsecs. And you can perhaps explain that by looking at what scale you would get. At what scale would the shear time for clouds to be, you asked about clouds being stretched out. So at what scale is the time for a cloud to be sheared apart comparable to the time scale for a clouds to grow by collision? And the spatial scale associated with creating these is about this scale. So I think that one can explain the characteristic cloud size, at least in the simulations, by this balance between collisions and shear.
So is the shear winning balance actually dominated by the shear
of the
galaxy, or is it dominated by
turbulent
shear?
It's by the shear of the galaxy, because if a cloud gets big, it actually starts to experience the shear of the galaxy.
Okay. Doesn't that take 100 million years?
Well, it shears on, it does begin to shear, yes. It would take 100 million years, but the time scale, the collisional time scale, is also long. Everything is long. Remember that everything is long. So we started to do some models where we include the effects of gravity here. First, let me just show you some results for stratified models where we have an external gravitational field representing vertical gravity. So this is radial, vertical, and azimuthal direction. We start with an isothermal gas, which is vertically stratified. And the size of this box is...
I'm sorry.
The size of the box is a kiloparsec. This is 600 parsecs, and that's 400 parsecs. The central density is 1 per cubic centimeter, and the initial scale height is 150 parsecs. And so this is at a total surface density of 10 solar masses per square parsec, which is comparable to that in the Milky Way.
How many scalars do you have in the vertical
direction? 6. So it collapses as it cools. It cools and collapses, and it still develops turbulence just as it does in the unstratified models. Although it collapses, then it redisperses because of the turbulence. Okay.
We're looking at density there, right?
Yes, that's density. So in terms of the profile, you can define an average profile by averaging the density in vertical planes. The scale height, this black is the total, green is the cold, blue is the thermally unstable part, and purple is the thermally stable warm gas. The effective scale height of the cold is about 70 parsecs. For the thermally unstable, it's about 100, and then the warm, although it's certainly not a Gaussian, is about 200 parsecs. So one can compare the turbulent model with what you would have if you just put in the same amount of gas that we had, you let it undergo a thermal instability, and all the gas would, cold gas would sink, all the cold gas that forms would sink to the midplane. So in that case, the cold mass fraction is about 3/4 of the total. The warm mass fraction is 1/4. And you can understand that by saying, what's the maximum amount of warm gas you can put in? There are some, at a given pressure, you can associate that with some total column density. There is for some warm, for some central pressure. But if the total amount of gas in the box is more than that, then you have to put the rest of it into cold gas. So that's what it does. It takes the fraction of the total that it can put in warm gas at the value of the pressure that's permitted for the warm medium, and it puts it in the warm, and then whatever is left over, in this case, it's a lot is left over, it will put in cold gas, and very little in unstable gas if it's just undergone thermal instability and there's no turbulence. In this case, the warm scale height is just set by vertical gravity and the sound speed of the warm medium. The cold scale height is smaller than it would be if it were just that, because it has this heavy warm layer sitting on top of it and compressing it. Comparing to the case with turbulence that I just showed you, the fraction of gas in the cold medium is lower, and basically some portion of this has been moved to the unstable, thermally unstable phase. And the scale height is, of course, much larger because turbulence is lifting it above the midplane. Well, yes, I'm aware of those results. I think it's not clear how to interpret them, I think. I think it's hard to say, not that much is known. Because they're edge-on, there are a lot of other things you don't know about those galaxies. Okay, so I'll say a little bit about self-gravity. So since we're interested in the interaction between turbulence and self-gravity, so just one important question is, how do thresholds for, oh look, the light's still on here. How do thresholds for gravitational instability, what determines thresholds for gravitational instability? Thank you, Charles. And for non-turbulent 2D models, the threshold for gravitational instability is a de Toomery Q of 1 plus a little bit, depending on the magnetic field strength. This shows unstable model, and the other I have here is stable. In 3D, the Toomery Q values that are at thresholds are somewhat different. For unmagnetized models, this is an unmagnetized model, the threshold for instability is less than 1, basically because gravity is diluted in 3D. But with turbulence driven by MRI, the threshold for gravitational instability is larger than 1. It's about 1.6. So what's happening here, is because it's turbulent, it's creating significant overdense regions, which are then more susceptible to gravitational instability than without turbulence. And magnetic fields are also important in removing angular momentum from those regions. So the MRI can decrease the surface density that's required for gravitational instability by more than 50%. So this is for single phase models. What we haven't done yet, and what we're going to do, is to look at how the critical Q depends on how turbulence affects the critical Q in multi-phase models. Those are single phase. Well, yes. I mean, only because self-gravity has the density fluctuations are not that large until gravity grabs onto them and grows
right,
them.
MRI MRI made it more unstable than self-gravity, right?
That's correct.
So reason for that is
that you have significant over densities. I mean, it's not order unity, but it's several tens of percent such that it can. Exactly. So you've driven large pieces of. No, but it can make a significant difference in terms of the tumor EQ, and that's important for the difference between, you know, less than one, which is never observed, and 1.5 or so, which is observationally typical.
It's a way to see leading wavelets.
Well, it's a way to see, we have leading wavelets regardless because we can put them in by hand. No, but we can put them in by hand, but it doesn't really help if they're not very high density. Yes?
It sounds like you're talking in swing rotation, and the idea is you only get one swing, so you have to start with a larger initial perturbation.
It's where do you get the sufficient amplitude leading perturbations?
I'm a little confused about referring to it as subspectral instability because
I say instability, although it's really an amplifier.
Okay. And then you have to
it is a nonlinear instability because it grows and it runs away.
Why does it run away?
Because it's so nonlinear.
Is that your criterion for calling it an instability that runs? I mean, clearly it's going to amplify a little bit even if you're below that criterion. So where do you
when it runs non-linear runaway. So we would like to see what the critical Q is in multiphase gas, and that is something for which you can all stay tuned. Okay, so here's my summary slide. I think we can stop here and I'll take questions. And I have some questions if you don't have questions. Yes?
Another point that's always concerned me in applying this to the galactic situation, and that is the cycle time from that in and out of the orbital region is not terribly long compared to the orbital time. So you're not dealing with the same stuff. And I wonder if you thought about what the criteria are for when that's a concern and when it isn't.
Well, but the only, I think that that's, only a fraction of the gas is molecular at any given, in an azimuthally average sense, and only a fraction of that gas turns into stars, so in an orbital time.
80% of the orbital.
In terms of the gas mass?
Yeah, it's 10% of the molecular, and the molecular is less than half of the total.
Let me get a different question from my head.
Okay.
Total gas mass in the galaxy is 10 to 9-ish?
That's molecular, but the atomic is more than that.
Factor 2?
A bit more, but yep.
If you have a mean star formation rate of the solar mass per year, then that suggests a lost time of a couple billion years.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
many orbits. Many orbits.
Like the lifetime of your simulations.
Right. But MRI develops, within a few orbits, right? Another question, which I did not address, is how do the interactions with spiral arms affect MRI? And I think that's an important question.
There might also be questions, just an assessment of global of the whole galaxy. Does that comparison change with radius?
Which comparison?
The lifetime of the the gas in your solar medium compared to the overall time?
Well, no, because the star formation rate decreases as you go to larger radii. The star formation timescale is basically proportional to the orbital time, empirically. Yeah. Well, we don't know for sure, but what I kind of argued, there is this, you can compare a shear time scale to a collision time scale, and then the size of the cloud, and then if you take the size of the cloud or the time scale of the collision, that's where it's going to be. Well, shear the interaction between these clouds are not internally disrupted because they're atomic clouds and stars don't form in atomic clouds. These are atomic clouds.
What's happening with them around being around for a couple hundred million years?
Well, not the individual ones aren't.
Shearing one doesn't an individual happen.
No, it doesn't last a hundred. It doesn't last for a full orbit. It's more like 10 to the 7 years.
Roughly, you have many clouds per MRL,
which is what they're saying to
have a single cumulative. Wait, say that again. Well, you have many clouds per MRL.
Yes. Then.
I'm trying to see how you go from.
Yeah, you have to have at least, I mean, you do have to have at least a few clouds per wavelength, otherwise it doesn't behave the same. But overall it does behave quite similarly. So in terms of the growth rates, as long as you have at least several clouds, we don't have any control over the number of clouds. So it's, that question would be hard, you know, we can't control that, so we can't really see how much that difference would make.
Are you saying that those galaxies with Q observed greater than 1.5 do not have star remnants? You said at some point you said the observation.
No. That's the critical Q for instabilities in the gas. For local, well, that's where the threshold. If you look at Martin and Kennicott's paper there, the mean threshold for star formation is at a Q of about 1.4.
I'm asking about galaxies with Q greater than 1.4 or 1.5.
Mm-hmm. But if you go in a given galaxy and you move in radius, then star formation cuts off when Q drops below 1.4 on average.
What about spiral structure?
Yeah, spiral structure, where they're beyond that point, you can have star formation within sort of only within spiral arms. So you can have a reduced level of star formation, but it tends to be just in spiral arms.
I'm asking, why is there a spiral structure in galaxies with Q greater than, or regions with Q greater than 1.5?
Well, it's a global phenomenon. It's a global, but this Q is Q gas. This is not Q in the stars. The spiral structure in the stars is
global
different.
Gas simulations, and those are global stellar.
Yeah, there's a difference between, this is Q in the gas. And you can have, you can have tidal driving by companions, a lot of stuff. But this is Q in the gas, not Q in the stars. Okay. which is not producing the spiral structure to begin with. The scale of spiral structure is associated with the stars because the wavelengths are a characteristic of the stellar medium, not the gaseous medium. Sorry, that what? Yes, we're not explaining that. It's an interesting and puzzling result. It's actually not independent. It varies a lot, but there's no secular dependence. So, I mean, I think what it is that's the velocity dispersion of the warm medium. So it kind of, you're not going to get above that. And you can drive towards it, but we haven't answered that question.
When Jerry Sullivan and I first looked at this problem, we were much more daunted by the competition from supernova than you are. I was scared of them because they absolutely, in terms of overall energetics, completely dominate the MRI in terms of energy injection in the regions of the galaxies where you have ongoing star formation.
Which is not everywhere.
Which is pretty much everywhere because it's on a volume average.
But you can't volume average because star formation takes place in molecular clouds.
You have warm, a lot of warm gas which has a large filling factor, so.
But that's not where star formation is occurring.
So you have, all right, I mean, nothing would delight me more than...
I'm not saying that we're explaining everything, but yes.
You have the fact that the overall supernova injection is orders of magnitude bigger is not an issue in terms, and gives you the right answer for the velocity dispersion.
But we're not claiming that that supernovae aren't important, but it is puzzling that there's no observed correlation between velocity dispersion and star formation. So you look in where there is star formation, which is in spiral arms, and you don't see any increase in velocity dispersion. So that I think a lot of the energy is actually going into breaking up molecular clouds. So you need it, because otherwise the clouds would all turn into stars, which would be a bad thing, because it doesn't happen. So I think a lot of the energy goes into fragmenting and redispersing clouds. And it's certainly a lot of the energy also is lost, out of the galaxy, because with correlated star formation, you have blowouts. And a lot of the energy is lost into the corona. So, Steve, we're not trying to explain everything.
I find it interesting, but the fact that the supernova may be, concentrated in spiral arms is, to me, it's not as damning an argument against them as, that I would just want to ignore them altogether.
Well, we're not ignoring them. We're just looking at another process to see whether it's important, and we find that it is important, but it certainly isn't enough to explain everything.
You could, in principle, actually, in addition to the MRI, have some kind of external stirring, which might be associated with them, and then it would be interesting to see if the results vary.
And as you said, the fact that they're concentrated also strengthens the venting.
Strengthens
the vertical venting.
Yes, exactly. So it's much less efficient. It's less efficient for its, and hot gas does not fill the galaxy. Yep.
Okay. So did you say what beta and the velocity dispersion were in your vertically stratified calculation?
The initial beta is the same.
So what about the final beta?
Yeah, we haven't measured it yet. So this is from last week, so we were just looking at we haven't measured it yet.
The reason I ask is that in unstratified calculations, I think it's a vertical scale of the calculation has something to do with where it's actually. And if you're not free to vary the vertical scale, temperature all the time. Mm-hmm. You have to do it all.
Right, it finds its own. It finds its own. Yes, well, when I get back, we'll be able to look at this. Maybe Rob has looked at it already while I've been here talking to you guys. Yep.
Is there a talking of the clouds?
Is there, I'm sorry?
Talking by the minute of the clouds when you...
Well, sure. We haven't, I mean, we haven't measured it directly. Well, for which clouds?
I'm thinking of the Kufis.
Yes, but I mean there has to be because the clouds, you know, rotate with respect to the magnetic field, so there will be stresses on their surfaces.
We have not measured them.
No. Ah, yes. So my questions were, for all of us, are what basic properties of the medium set the saturated state amplitudes of MRI? So we've added kind of a data point to all of the results that are already existing on the saturation amplitude, namely how things behave when you have a medium that is non-uniform. But I think that it would be nice for us to understand what sets the saturated state amplitude. So I think that's kind of a goal for everyone. I think another question that I have for all the accretion disk people is what other accretion disks might have two-phase structure and what would be the consequences if they did? So my understanding is that there is coronal gas in AGN which can be existing kind of co-spatially, perhaps co-spatially with colder gas. So is it possible that this gas is actually co-spatial so that it's mixed together? Or if not, why not? And if you really have a corona, what's the relationship between the thin disk and the corona? So I think that galactic disks are different in some ways, but I think that they are at least posing some questions that are of interest for the accretion disk community in general. Anyone have answers to these questions? Okay.
Two-phase structure 6 or 7 years ago, mm-hmm. and after a while decided it wasn't a very productive line of thought.
Mm-hmm. So why is that?
Basically because the shear is so strong.
That?
The shear is so strong.
So strong that what?
It would just be very hard to keep the phases thermally separated. And there's also a big difference here.
Shear between what and what do you mean?
We have these cold lumps that are hotter external environment.
Uh-huh.
And the cold lumps have some radial thickness. And so over time, they get sheared out.
Right.
And that makes it easier to evaporate them because now there's a big surface to volume ratio.
Mm-hmm. But they can also be colliding with each other to get bigger. So you can. So I don't know what size scale is okay.
Let me say that. Mm-hmm. I tried to make it work. Mm-hmm. I eventually decided that my time was better spent on other ideas.
Mm-hmm. Are you using a lower dependent?
Anyway, the big difference also, of course, is in the heating distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, the vertical structure in your case would change significantly if you had a different heating rate, probably other than constant premium volume. On the other hand, in galactic disks, that may not be a bad approximation.
Yes. Well, because you're saying that in accretion disks the heating is not uniformly distributed.
It is probably not that. And also, and the cooling function, you're in a different regime of density and temperature and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That characteristic two-phase system there probably won't exist.
But how do you heat the corona if all of the heating is actually created in the thin disk?
That's a good question.
Okay.
It may not be.
Well, the corona...
The finding that heating distribution is many ways to move energy. Where would we like to be soon?
Well, so, but do you think that a lot of the heating is actually in the corona? I mean, I thought that there just wasn't enough mass in the corona to account for its heating.
Most of it isn't, but even if a little bit of the disk gets up, a little bit of the energy gets up.
It's also not clear that the corona needs to exist over a large radial extension of disk.
It also depends on which sort of medium or sort of matter we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Eve, if I could just ask a mm-hmm. quick before just mm-hmm. away, what was the ratio of B5 to BZ to BR that you were typically finding in your simulations? You had it up earlier, but I've forgotten.
I can't remember. We could look again.
The B5 and BR were rather close.
Yes, and BZ is smaller by at least a factor of two.
Whereas in the simulations, B5 tends to dominate BR by about an order of magnitude. And I thought in the galaxy, that B5 also, you were predominantly B5 by about an order of magnitude.
No, I don't think it's an order of magnitude because it can't be because the irregular is comparable to the regular. And the irregular is in all directions. So.
But there has been a suggestion there's a discrepancy between if you calculate the ratio of mean to net field from a direction sensitive method, which is an orientation sensitive method, and that could be resolved by finding the balance of the population.
That could be what?
It could be resolved by finding the balance of the
population. This maybe is. Let's see. So that's B squared. So yes, BY is larger than BX, and BZ is a lot smaller.
Very different.
But in part, this may be because our box is not bigger by a factor of 2 pi in the azimuthal direction. Yeah, so this box is a cube. So, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons to do global thin disk models is to have realistic as Charles says, is not to put in by hand the aspect ratios of the computational volume, but to let it find its own, because that can affect the relative amplitudes of the magnetic field in different directions. And of course, one also wants to know, what sets the scale length for reversals, a lot of other things.
Okay.